Welcome to Sundial. I'm Carlos Frias. The streets of Miami's ritziest neighborhoods flood, but Liberty City is bone dry.
When I was a child, my grandfather always would say, they're going to come take Liberty City because we don't flood.
The neighborhood sits just 12 feet above sea level, but that slightly higher ground is gold these days in South Florida, with rising seas caused by climate change. That makes Liberty City irresistible to developers, and also to filmmakers who wanted to document what happens when gentrification comes for one of Miami's historically black neighborhoods. The result is the new film, Raising Liberty Square. The movie traces the redevelopment of Liberty Square, which was once one of the oldest segregated public housing projects in the country. Real estate developers promised to build new, mixed-income housing that wouldn't displace any of the residents. The film shows just how those promises fall apart. The film runs at Coral Gables Cinema from January 26th through February 1st. It'll air nationally on PBS January 29th. Katya Essen is the Academy Award-nominated director. She spent years filming what happened when the city turned over public housing to a private company for redevelopment. It's a time-lapse of a broken promise, and it's a cautionary tale. Katya, welcome to the show. It's great to get to talk with you.
Thank you, Carlos. Very happy to be here.
Well, you know, we were just kind of mentioning this between us, but we all, our staff here at Sundial, we all got a chance to screen the film over the weekend. And I think we were all moved. We were all moved in different ways, in different parts. And I know I can speak for myself, kind of unexpected. There are these moments where there's, like we said, it's this promise of redeveloping this project neighborhood, this project that was built in the 30s. And, you know, it's this sale that they're going to make it into something beautiful and new. And there's that emotion of turning it over to the keys for the first time. And you're moved by that. But then the movie keeps going. And I think that that's like in that part is the whole of the controversy, is like the fullness of what happens with a project that comes with so much promise. And then you get to the point where you're, you know, these are the results. I guess, talk to me about what were some of your favorite moments looking back as you put together, and favorites sometimes are not, right, are not great, but moments that really moved you as you were editing the film.
Yeah, you now made it, you said it correctly. Favorite is a difficult word, because there were many really intense and tough moments. And then, of course, as a filmmaker, also moments that I realized, wow, they have to be in the film, because that will get to people and that will have an emotional impact, you know. And I don't want to give the ending away, but of course, you know, the arc of Aaron, who is from the community and works for the developer, that was an important moment, his decision at the end. Also, just really being very close to the resident of Liberty Square, Sam Kenley and her kids, just really being at their side while they were kind of like a boat in the storm, kind of pushed that way, this way, you know, should I stay, should I go, you know, trying to go, not finding anything. These heart-wrenching decisions, you know, her oldest son, Joshua, who then when his mom decided that she would want to leave, he didn't want to leave. And, well, that, you know, so.
Yeah. No, I think that what the movie does is you paint the players, right? And you take us, it's not like a policy movie. It's very much an emotional, what happens when your neighborhood changes, like in a way that it must change, but also the question is like, who are these changes for? Who is this supposed to benefit? The people who already live here. So you take us inside the world of people who live in the square. You take us meeting some of the people with the development company, the Related group, who was redeveloping that. And even some characters within the Related. There's one guy who helps sell the project to the community, and he also lives in a similar project that things went awry. And he's saying, like, I'm your representative. I promise you things will not go awry because I'm invested in it too. That's Aaron, who you're mentioning in the film. And I think, talk to me about what it was like trying to get those people to trust you to tell their story.
Yeah, that was, I mean, it took us 6 years to make the film.
Wow. You lived with that for 6 years.
Yeah. And I live very close to Liberty Square and Liberty City. Hmm. So I'm still spending a lot of time there. And I approached the project with a very different interest at first. It was like a historical interest, you know, that when I found out it was supposed to be razed to the ground, and you mentioned before, it's one of the most historical, one of the first segregated public housing projects in this country built during the New Deal in the 30s. As a European, German-born, I was like, how can they tear that down? You know, it's like history. So I came in with this historical interest. And then when I started to talk to people and to the residents, they really educated me about something that I had no idea about. I did not know that Liberty City sits on a ridge. I did not know what climate gentrification was. So then I realized, oh, wait a second, that's a very different film. And you asked me gaining the trust. That's always the big question when you're an outsider coming into a community that's not your own. You know, how do you avoid extractive, filmmaking? How do you make a collaboration with the people in your film? And everybody, each filmmaker has their own way. I always look at it, you know, I'm getting such a gift, such a present from everybody by, you know, giving me their stories, sharing their time, their lives with me, that I'm always thinking, what can I give? And I asked them, what can I do? And it was some things were easy here because we have a school in the film. I know how to make films. So I made films for the school. You know, I went on trips and I made whatever films they needed. You know, the Hampton House. We made films about the Hampton House that they used. I made films.
The historic Hampton House, which is a place where a lot of performers who were black performers, is where they stayed because during segregation, they couldn't stay in places like Miami Beach where they were performing. And you mentioned the school. So there's a school in Liberty Square. So Liberty Square is kind of like almost like the birthplace of Liberty City. It's almost like let's say the heart of Liberty City. And the school is on that property and it's supposed to be part of the redevelopment. And you start very early on by finding out that the school is going to be displaced. So immediately you start thinking the people in these communities, you know, what's as central to someone as a school, especially in South Florida, where the first thing you ask somebody is like, hey, where'd you go to high school? You know, and that helps stratify where you are in the world. So you kept showing up is what it sounds like. You kept going to different events.
Yeah, I kept showing up. I mean, that's the right expression. I just kept showing up. I did films for churches, but it also then later became, and it was funny in your interview, you said, you know, filmmakers were drawn. I was looking around often and I mean, we were the only team crew in the room often always at these meetings that were going on. So I realized we're the only one really telling the story.
And you take us inside these meetings. These meetings become these public forums where people who live in Liberty Square, who live in that housing project, are getting to have a back and forth communication with the developers, the folks who've been hired to redevelop it, You know, the county owns it, it's public owned housing, and they basically turned over the redevelopment to this private company who will then run it, who will then decide, you know, whether they raise rents, who's allowed back in, you know, because you got to move out.
Who's managing.
And you're in those meetings, and those meetings get very tense.
Yes. And that's what I, you know, during these years, I would get calls at any day or nighttime. People call me, hey, get ready, it's going to go down. And then I would go, okay, when? Well, we can't tell you. Okay, what's happening? Now we can't tell you. I'm like, okay, all right, I'm just gonna, just let me know. So we were called on all the time to document this. This is happening. Come here, quickly. So we just kept being there and documenting.
And it was both in small rooms, like, little conference rooms, to these big public forums. And some of those commentaries were from locals who really spoke very passionately. And we have a clip from one of those discussions from the film.
I'm a resident here in Liberty Square. I'm very concerned. I really don't care about a shopping area. We want a history to continue. We don't want our history to stop because y'all tear down Liberty Square. I want to live right here in my community where I was raised in. I want to raise my kids in my community so they can be a part of my history.
And that's so much of a theme, is that you're not building on a empty piece of land where nobody has ever lived. You're attempting to do something that's going to affect hundreds of people, you know, dozens, maybe hundreds of families. Talk to me about those kinds of scenes, making how that affected you as you're out with your camera, standing on the other side of your camera, seeing that kind of passion.
Yeah, these meetings were incredibly intense for us. And also, of course, you know, we were in the room covering all this, and on the other side is the county and also the developer watching us film. And I kept feeling their eyes on me sometimes, thinking like, should we maybe kick them out? But they didn't, you know, so we were there and we captured it all. And especially the clip that you just played, you know, just to say we really want to preserve our history. That was extremely touching to me, you know, and the danger of losing that, the danger of erasure of this entire community was terrifying.
Did you, we start to see both sides there, the city and the developer saying, look, we promise you this is what's going to happen. And then you have some folks who are older, who are like, you can tell they're, you know, they're the elders there who are saying, we've seen this before. The whole reason this place exists is because it was the same affordable housing agreement that led to Liberty Square. Like, there's this quote where someone says, there was a hidden motive then, there's a hidden motive now. And it's very ominous. And that's early in the film. It's very ominous. Talk to me about that, about this idea of, I don't know, trying to empathize with both of those groups in there.
Well, I started this project like the audience is starting the project with a lot of hope. It was supposed to be very different than regular mixed income, where everybody is kind of moved out, you tear it down and then you build it up and then people get lost and whatever, you know, not everybody moves back. Here it was the promise that people could stay, that they would, that the community would not break apart, that people would just be moved in empty units that were available, and then, you know, there would be a block by block demolition and construction, so nobody would have to leave. And that also, that made sense to me. That was like, wow, this could be the answer of not breaking up communities. So I had that hope too at the beginning, very much, you know. So I was going on this journey to see where the story is going.
Our guest today is Katya Essen. She's the director and producer of the film Raising Liberty Square. Her film opens in Coral Gables Cinema on Friday, and it'll play through February 1st, and then it'll have its national broadcast premiere on PBS January 29th. Katya, you obviously spent a lot of time in that community. Talk to me about your connections to Miami, because you said you're not a local, and you talked about having to continue to show up. But what brought you here? What kind of drew your interest, and what kind of makes you an expert at this point to be able to be here?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Germany, and I came to Miami in 87 to study film and theater at the University of Miami.
Oh, okay.
I wanted to study both, and that was possible here. And I had a friend, one of the producers, Corinna Sager, went here, and she said, she sold it to me and also my parents, which was important. A great university, you should go here. And that's how I came to Miami in 87, but always thinking that I would come back to Germany, which then I never did.
Oh, that's so interesting. So you came And you liked it here enough to stay.
Yeah.
What was it about the community that struck you that was so interesting to
well,
you?
Well, I'm on my second Cuban husband, so probably that has something to do with it. I could never imagine to live in Germany again. Actually, I moved to New York for a couple of years, but I always missed Miami. I always came back here on vacation, and I always knew I wanted to come back here. I just really fell in love with Miami, and yes, with the of course the sun, but also, you know, the mix, the diversity, everything. I love Miami.
What was your neighborhood like growing up? Like, what was your city and what was your neighborhood?
I come from a very cold city. It's called Hamburg. It's at the sea. It's literally, it's very cold temperature wise, but the people people are also very cold. It's a very pretty city, but it's very cold. So when I come back now and I make my weird jokes, they look at me like I'm an alien.
Oh, you're a Miami girl now. They don't get you over there.
No, they don't get me at all.
So, but specifically about then Liberty City, because Liberty City is obviously has been, certainly since the project, you know, was kind of carved out as the black area of town, and folks were kind of redlined in there and kept in there even after after post-segregation. Talk to me about how you started to get interested in Liberty City. Like, what was your exposure to it?
Well, my first exposure to it, and my big claim to fame and my street cred in Liberty City is that when I went to UM and I was just there for a couple of weeks, my English was really bad. A producer showed up at the film class and said, "Hey, who wants to work on a music video?" And I was like, me. And then they told me where to be, and that was Liberty City. I didn't even know where that was. I had no idea.
Wait, so you were working on or starring in a music
video?
No, not starring.
I was the only female behind the camera on various Two Live Crew music videos that I probably cannot
Two
say.
Two Live
that,
Crew, that's mm-hmm. it. That's it. You got your streak right.
I totally got it. And it's like sometimes I can mention the title, sometimes I can't. I always just love the story because I'm still very, very good friends with the DP who did those videos.
The director of photography.
Yeah, the director of Jose Osejo, who did our aerials for this documentary. And I would walk up to him, you know, they would sing, Two Live Crew would sing and rap and whatever. And I'm like, what are they singing? And Jose would just say, I don't know. He would not want to repeat the lyrics.
Oh my God,
it was
that
so
is
raunchy.
So funny.
Yeah.
That is so funny. So really, you got thrown into the deep end of the Miami pool.
Totally.
Right away.
Without knowing. I mean, I had no idea at that time. But that was my first connection to Liberty City. But little did I know that 20 years later, you know, I would make this film.
You said that you still live nearish Liberty City.
Yes.
That's a choice, right? Like to live in an area that's mixed with different backgrounds and not like places where you run from people of color, you know what I mean?
Yes.
I'm curious what that's been like for you.
And it's like I always try to avoid that because technically I live on Miami Beach, mm-hmm. but I really don't because I live in the poor part of Normandy Isle, which is like the last mixed and diverse, I feel, an not developed area of the beach.
Right.
And I'm in Liberty City in 10, 15 minutes, you know, so I'm like right between the beach and Liberty City, so to speak.
I'm curious, as someone who had an early exposure to it, you know, working on rap videos, which is hilarious, to then making a film, how your perception of Liberty City changed or was reinforced, or like how your thoughts about it evolved.
I felt it had, you know, it's like when I came back to Miami in 2016, and in between I had been, but then that's when I really looked and I was like, oh my God, the city has exploded. Mm. Like every single neighborhood has changed and it developed, and like high risers here and whatever. Only Liberty City seemed like frozen in time to me, you know, when I came back. It's you see the buildings have not hardly changed, you know?
And for better or for worse, right? Like your movie does something really interesting, which it gets into explaining like why an area gets left behind, right? Like you guys really get into, you have even this great historical footage of white flight, like when people in Liberty City, you know, integration happens. Segregation is struck down and people start trying to move out of Liberty City. Black families that live there wanted to live, you know, even a street over, and they have protests and there's white flight. And your film does this really interesting thing where it connects the dots, like, all right, white people left. And then you have this area where the city stops investing in the area. And then that leads to fewer businesses investing. And that leads to a concentration of poverty and disenfranchisement. Talk to me about how much of that you had to learn yourself before you could film it.
Everything. And that was one of the reasons why I, you know, 6 years is a long time to work on a film. And you need that as a documentarian, you need that fire and that desire to do it. And that was definitely the initial push for me. You know, later it became about the people. But I was so embarrassed that I had lived here for so many years in Miami and I did not know anything about the Black history of Miami. And that I had to learn everything. I had to learn everything. And I also, it was very clear that we can, you know, it's like it's so easy to say, oh yeah, Liberty City is a dangerous, violent neighborhood. You know, that's what people kept repeating. But if you don't understand why, you know, that would be, you know, like a huge mistake not to explain how it got to this point.
And you do it very succinctly and not in a pedantic way at all. Like, it's very much like this historical video, and it kind of propels you through, and then you find out kind of where you are now. Because if you're thinking, you know, you're thinking early 60s to 1980s, that's not really to 1980 when you have the protest that after the McDuffie
riots. Right.
Leading to that moment, you connect those dots, and then you get us to where we are now.
And you say connect the dots, and we just had our hometown premiere last, you know, with the community in Liberty City with the community, and that was the most important screening. Although we have had screenings really literally all over the country and in many places all over the world, but that's what elders and other people said. You know, the film connects the dots.
I'm very curious about the response to it, because I'm sure you showed up. I mean, here you are, you're fair skinned, you got your red hair, you know, you got your light eyes, and you're like, I'm going to tell the story of this community. How did you feel like people, once you got to the end, felt like you were able to translate that story in a way that people felt like they were represented?
Yes, I mean it's so hard. I wish always that I love when other people say that, but I have heard it now from many people from the stage. Right. You know, when we had Q&As after, like thanking me and the team to tell that story and to connect the dots and to uncover the lie, as Valencia Gander, the climate act organizer in the film, says. You know, it's like all these, when I love to hear when people from the community describe the film or what it does for them, because I'm like, wow, yeah.
Take me to one of those moments. Was there, especially after the first screening, was there a moment where you were kind of holding your breath and someone gives you some kind of feedback that really crystallizes it for
you?
Oh
my God. It's like our premiere at Hot Docs in Toronto, which is like a huge, very important documentary festival that was in March. And we were there with four of our protagonists. And they were that was the first time, you know, the first audience, first time for them to be on stage. And they all spoke to it. And I had to like fight my tears. And also to hear from them how grateful they were that this film exists, and how it affected them, and even affected, maybe, again, I don't want to give away what happens, but affected decisions, because my coming back and asking questions sometimes also did something, for example, for Aaron, you know, that he said, you left, but then I was thinking, the team left, and I was thinking, you know, what am I doing? So
interesting. They were testing. You got this feeling of being tested. Like, did you get the footage that you needed, or are you going to be here until we figure out how this thing ends up? Are you going to be here through the end?
No, it was more like the film, the film affected their decision. I mean, his decision in this case, you know.
Right.
But it was also really interesting to hear from you know, from people how, like, they were making fun of how they at first didn't know, you know, who the hell am I? Who is this person with a weird German accent asking these questions? And now, you know, seeing how important this film hopefully will be for everybody to use, you know, to move the needle, maybe.
Were there, talk to me about some of the people that are in the film that you felt close to. I mean, because you can't work on something for that long without feeling very close to some, being invested in people's outcomes.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, this is one of the honestly a little bit difficult for me, because I interviewed so many people, so many amazing, fascinating, interesting people, and in the end, we have four protagonists, and maybe a fifth one, and then we have a chorus of elders, right? But we have four protagonists, and it was really difficult not to include all these other voices. But this is the problem of filmmaking. Then you have to, it's like casting, nearly like a narrative film. You have to say, okay, who can tell this part of the story? Who can tell this part of the story? And it was hard for me to also explain people, sorry, you know, you're not in the film. But in the end, most of the people said, you know, it's representative of all of us. It's our community. But yeah, I got very close. It's like I feel I have family now. You know, it's like Dr. Pinkney is like my grandmother. You know, she's the one that saved the historical Hampton House, right? She's a very important historian. Her husband is one of the Tree of Knowledge gentlemen that sit under the tree at the street corner, the chorus of men.
Right, you know, there's remember? this great scene where you go back to them and you interview this kind of group of elders of older folks who've lived in the community right around this tree area,
right.
And they're like the conscience of the neighborhood, the historical, the what would you call it, the historical knowledge of the neighborhood.
Exactly,
right?
But the teacher Samantha Quarterman and I, we got very close. Also, you know, Sam Kenley and her kids. It's like I'm the godmother to her children. You know, we took Joshua to New York to the Human Rights Watch Festival. You know, he's now very close with my husband. You know what I mean? It's like we became very, very close.
This movie changed your life.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I'm so curious about, you know, you're from Germany, and you're when you come to Miami, you get this brush of what Americanism is, right? And the racism that is built into, like, that the fact that this community is the only reason it exists, where it exists and how it exists is because of racism, right? Like very near in time.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, did you have anything to relate that to from what your growing up was?
I think, and it has happened in other projects. I think sometimes, and with this film, I had to become very intentional in what I'm doing as a filmmaker in terms of collaboration and in terms of the power dynamics and in terms of the question who should tell whose story, mm-hmm. right? But if you look at my other projects, I have always done it. I just have done it instinctively. And it has helped me often that I am from Germany. You know, that I don't I'm not American. And
you don't have the baggage.
Exactly. I come without baggage. And I also get away sometimes with questions that, you know, might be more naive. I had no fear going into Liberty City.
Because nobody had beat that into you that this was was supposed to be dangerous.
Exactly. And we were kind of asked to have a police escort at first, you know, and I was like, okay, that's not going to work.
That's so interesting that was a suggestion. And can you imagine how that would have changed people's willingness to open up?
I know. Yeah. So,
well, it kind of reminds me of Tom Wolfe, the author Tom Wolfe. He would write, you know, he felt like he could never fit in to be an insider to wherever he was writing about, so he would always wear his white suit. So he would stand out as an outsider, and that he felt like that was a benefit to him. So your red hair is your white suit, I guess.
Exactly. And we were everybody knew us, you know. There were drug deals, yes, happening on, what is it, 18th Avenue, you know, and we were happening to point the camera there, and I'm like, oops, sorry guys, don't worry, don't worry, and they're like, yeah, you know.
Wow.
It's like, so yeah,
we were talking about this part about how it really affected and changed your life. I think the next thing that, I mean, just as we were chatting in the beginning, this is obviously the movie screening at the Coral Gables Cinema. And it's going to be on nationally PBS, so people are going to get a chance to see it when it airs on the 29th. But you had other screenings set up that are not, that those theaters backed away because of the city and political clout. I know you're kind of cringing over there because it's because it does go towards, like, the power of those groups, like a huge developer, the related group, a government, one of the largest governments, right? The Miami-Dade County, who's got billions of dollars worth of a budget, and some of those places pulled back. That's what was that like?
No, but it started from the beginning that when I asked some artists that were involved in the development, you know, just creating art. I wanted to interview them, and they made it very clear if there's any criticism, we're out.
Oh, wow. interesting. Because they were funded.
Because we don't want, exactly.
Because they were funded in different ways, either by the private development firm in the movie, or by city government too, which would gives out, through different companies, gives out grants.
Yeah, it was the developer in this case. But yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And so what did it mean to you then? I mean, does that hurt the reach that you hope for the movie, or is it the fact that it's going to be aired nationally? Does that make up for it?
I mean, that was a big decision that we as a filmmaking team had to make. You know, there were other streamers interested, like Hulu was interested. You know, it got a pretty good buzz during the years because we're the first film that is combining or showing the intersection of climate and housing crisis, you know, and with this new thing, climate gentrification,
which is basically, just to break it down, it's wealthy people moving into poorer areas, and the climate being like, this is high ground that is less prone to flood than is low-lying ground, like beautiful South Beach or whatever, which, you know, when it rains is under 3 feet of water.
Correct. That's the case in Miami. Miami is very unique in that way. You know, climate gentrification in New Orleans is different, or in Hawaii now with the wildfires, it happens after the disaster. Here it's happening before.
Oh, interesting.
But now I lost my point. What was I saying? Sorry.
No, we were just, I mean... Just
oh, right. And then we decided to, yes, we want to be on PBS, because that will allow the people that we think and hope should and can and will see the film can see it. You know, this can be now seen all over the country for free everybody.
And those are the kind of people who could show up at a public meeting, right? Because
exactly.
those public meetings that you capture in the film, it is people from the community that are able to have their voices heard, even if ultimately some of that pushback seemed to get kind of steamrolled. Did that surprise you that there wasn't more receptiveness to the public commentary of it?
You mean like why that?
Yeah, the folks that came out and really had, like, you know, like this woman who mm-hmm. heard from the clip from your movie, that didn't sway things ultimately. It didn't change things ultimately for how they wanted the project to unfold. That must have been frustrating to see.
Yes, and of course, again, I'm not an organizer or an activist, but I just know from the groups that are now wanting to use the film and are working with us, you know, us handing the film over to them, that let's put it that way. We had a screening for some of these groups that were also at the table, you know, negotiating with the developer and the county about how it should be. And that screening was very, very painful. People were crying and just very, because it brought, it's six years later now, but it brought back the fight to them also. It reminded them of how the hopes, the fight, the broken promises, you know, it brought it all back. So that was, I can just see it through them, you know, like feel it through them. How frustrating that must be for the ones who work, you know, who do this
right
fight.
Our guest today is Katja Essen. She's the director and producer of the film Raising Liberty Square. The film opens at Coral Gables Cinema Friday, January 26th, and will play through February 1st. It'll also have its national broadcast premiere on PBS January 29th. You know, there's so much, this film covers so much territory, and it goes through 2023. I mean, it really, you guys get it, you know, very, to the very near past here. But even, I imagine, like, even in that time, now that we're in 2024, there has been fallout from it. And there's a little bit of epilogue in your film about, you know, where people's lives have ended up. Talk to me about some of the things that you've seen happen that maybe break your heart, and kind of what are you hoping that that hopefully will take a turn, you know, that will be positive.
I mean, we're hoping very much that this film can affect the story it's actually telling, because the Liberty Square development is still at the very beginning.
We should say it's still ongoing. I want to say it's like nine
city blocks.
Nine city blocks.
Three are only done. They're just working on the fourth. So the hope, of course, of these organizations that are now using the film is that to get some accountability to the developer and like see some of the things that you don't see in the film being fixed and corrected.
I mean, one of the interesting things that happens is obviously is you know, I kept coming back to the question, who does this serve? The redevelopment, who does this serve? And I think about, you know, the promise that the former mayor Carlos Jimenez says at one point, he said that not a single person was displaced. And the truth is, you find out later in the film that, I mean, this is not giving too much away in the sense, but put into context, that only five families returned. Only five families, and hundreds of people left. And it's not necessarily people being moved. It's people who don't get approved to come back because there's, you know, it becomes this whole issue. You get into Section 8. You explain Section 8 housing and how some people are given a coupon, you know, so that they can, you know, move to other places. And then you're technically supposed to be allowed to come back. But somebody has to approve you coming back. And without getting into the details, that the population totally changes. And you have these great moments where you're filming of what that area looks like now. And, you know, you see a lot fewer black and brown faces. And that's the gentrification right there. I'm curious what that's been like for you to see it. It's kind of like watching a train wreck that you can't affect at that point, right? You're kind of looking as a person from the outside a little bit.
Yeah, definitely from the outside. But again, I made that journey also with Aaron that we talked about, the young man who is from the community and lives in the community and works for the developer in the film. That he himself would have never imagined that so many people would actually take the vouchers and leave, you know, so he did not expect that to happen. And I did not expect that to happen, you know, and that is a whole different program to kind of dissect why people took the vouchers, you know.
Right. There is that kind of interesting thing where it's almost like being on a game show, like, well, you can take the money now or you can wait to see what's behind door number two, you know. And a lot of people, it looks like we're like, well, this is secure. Me coming back is not necessarily secure. And you make this interesting point, too, that for people that come back, they have like a quote unquote contract to be able to come to, you know, to live there. But that can be altered after a year. Your rent can go up. Your, you know, the whole management of it can change, you know. And it's the idea of also people on the outside managing a neighborhood that's been, you know, that are coming from the outside to manage a different neighborhood.
Right.
And the lack of sensibility there.
Right.
I'm curious, you know, kind of looking forward then, you know, after having, like, what is your interest now? Like, when you do a movie like this, I feel like it changes you in some ways. Can you talk to me about that? Some of the ways that it's making you think differently as you move ahead and how it's changed your life?
I mean, it definitely has, you know, given me so much more information about and worry about the cities of the future and like the really desire to talk more to people about, you know, the importance of public housing, which I also didn't understand. It has such a bad rep somehow, public housing, you know, in this country that... when you though realize it is absolutely necessary, you know, and the question, should housing be a human right? And should government kind of hand the responsibility of housing over to the private market? Will that work? I mean, like really the worry of how will that all play out in the future? You know, that is definitely something that I'm much more worried about now.
How did your knowledge and your perception of that change? Like you said, you come from, you know, a different kind of background and seeing the idea of public housing. Why did you feel like, what did you see about it that you're like, this is a necessary thing that is, especially that you see in the example of this?
I mean, and this is, of course, also a reference that I have as a German, right? That in Germany, the social network is so much more strong and the rent control and the whole rent and social housing situation is, we're taking that so for granted to see how fragile, and then also living in New York, where it's at least there's rent control, you know, at least there's some strong structure of organization. And then seeing, watching here the organizations in Miami, you know, there are, but fight against windmills. I mean, I'm in awe of these organizers. I'm absolutely in awe, you know, that they're not giving up, because it's like, it's so overwhelming. Everything is against them, you know?
Right. What did you learn about that? Like, after seeing that whole idea of, you know, having this kind of background where you've seen, you know, rent control and things like that, you know, what did you learn from that, from having spent so much time kind of examining that issue?
That it's absolutely, I mean, it is necessary. Here, it's just pushing, so to speak, poor, low income to the edge. You know, now they're, in this case, a lot of people went south, and it's just pushing away the problem. And
I know everybody asks you this now. This is the thing we were talking about, like, well, so what's the solution?
And you're right. I asked you before not to ask me that, remember, because I'm not a specialist.
You're not a policymaker. You're a filmmaker who becomes like our ears and our eyes in these places.
Right.
I'm curious, working with it, you know, having done this, have you seen areas where it does work? Have you seen examples? Is it either from your own country or working here and living here so many years? Have you seen some medium where this kind of revitalizing actually helps an area rather than turning it over to somebody else? You know,
so-called revitalizing. Yeah, I mean, it's like, for example, when we screened in Toronto, there is a public housing project that is also very, very challenged and had a lot of problems. But in the end, I think the city looked at it as positive. You know, there are little examples here and there. And Aaron, in the film again, oftentimes on stage, gets that question. Aaron, give us an example where mixed income housing actually worked, where that worked. You know, and then he will give his answer. So there is overwhelming examples where it hasn't really worked for the original residents, you know. So that's the question, you know. That's something that I also really would like to do with the film, for the audience to look critical at this current model, which is mixed income, you know, and like think about, can that work?
Like, are there enough examples already that we can say, absolutely, you know, with any kind of certainty, this doesn't work at all, or there is some medium where it does work?
What has to happen, like, in to speak again, like with Aaron's voice, because there are people on our team that say mixed income is just a tool of gentrification. Aaron still believes firmly that mixed income is the solution, but it has to be done right. So what does that mean? It's like also to preserve not only the community, but also institutions that have been created in there, like the school, like Mega, that's in the film, you know,
right,
and not get rid of them and put a new school there.
Right. And you, that's an interesting thing, too, because you, in the film, not only approaches the residents there, it touches on this school, a school for like kids, I don't know if you would call them high-risk kids, but kids who kind of have fallen through the cracks through irregular public education, and she makes it available to these kids who serve that community.
Yeah.
And that school is affected in the film. So it's kind of like a remaking of that entire, of an entire community.
Right.
I'm curious, there's whether what the conversations have been like with some of the elders, because something that you showed in the entire film where these folks who keep saying, we're old enough to have seen this happen, and we're telling you that this is not going to work. And, you know, younger people, are like Aaron is kind of hopeful at part of the movie, and you see them kind of proven right. When you were filming moments like that, were you also curious, how is this going to turn out?
Yeah, as I said at the beginning, I went on this journey. I did not know at the beginning how it would turn out. I was very hopeful also, you know, and the elders, I mean, and that is one reaction now from the elders, that this, you know, some say the film connects the dots, but the elders also are saying, wow, there is now a document that shows how history has repeated and repeated and repeated over and over again.
Yeah, you've kind of demonstrated how literally how it can go wrong,
right,
for a community. I'm curious about what you're interested in now as a creative, as a filmmaker. Like, what did this open up for you, and kind of what areas does it have you thinking about now?
I have to tell you, and people ask that all the time, and they ask that at every film festival, and I dread that question, because this film has been the most challenging and important film I've done in my career. And it took a lot, and I don't want to cry right now, but I feel like crying. It took a lot out of me because of the relationships, the feeling with people when hopes are broken. You know, now we started the impact campaign of the film, which is even more intense, I feel, because now we're working with these organizers, you know, and they're using the film as a tool. And of course, I'm hoping that the film will live up to everybody's expectation and will actually help, you know, them in their campaigns and in their work. But that's a lot. I put a lot of pressure on myself, you know, that the film does all that. I sometimes have to remind myself and everybody around me to say, listen, the film is not the campaign. The film is a tool. The film is a tool. So I'm very much involved in this impact campaign right now. We're having, as you said, you know, we're opening now theatrically here in Miami. Then we have PBS. But then we have in February, March into April, we have like nearly every weekend these organizations are screening the film for their people, you know, for their neighborhood, for, you know, every organization has took on a screening. So I'm going to be very much involved in that.
It's interesting that you came into this as a documentarian and it made you a little bit of an activist, turned you into an activist.
Exactly. I was actually on a panel at the Sheffield Film Festival, like trying to figure out, and they were there to convince me that I am an activist. And I kept saying, no, I'm an artist. I'm a filmmaker. And they're like, no, you're doing exactly what an activist does. You organize, you whatever. But yes, it overlaps. It does. Mm. I have to tell you that I'm looking forward to do something light with humor where there's not so much pressure and responsibility resting on me. So I'm actually doing a three-part series about Florida.
Oh.
North, Central, and South. And it's history, but it's also a lot of, you know, the abundance of nature and all the animals that are here. And it's a little bit this undertone of like, you know, the history, you know, why is Florida so crazy? But in a light way.
Well, hopefully folks will get enough from your work here to be ready for that.
Right.
Katya, thank you so much for making time today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Our guest today was Katya Essen. She's the director and producer of the film Raising Liberty Square. The film opens at Coral Gables Cinema on Friday, January 26, and will play through February 1st. It'll also have its national broadcast premiere on PBS January 29th. And that's Sundial for Monday, January 22nd. Leslie Ovalle-Atkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Baena is our producer. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News. Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. Peter J. Meritz is WLRN's VP of Radio, and our engineer is Richard Ives. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. Coming up tomorrow on the program, a cellist and music educator who describes himself as a DJ and an MC. Guy Michel joins us. I'm Carlos Frias. Good vibes only.
WLRN Public Media.